welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On August 27th, Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan sponsored a candidate and community healthcare forum on the Franklin College campus in Franklin, Indiana. Moderated by Dr. Rob Stone, the panel included healthcare experts Dr. Mary Beth Hensley and Dr. Michael Colenda, the director of Windrose Health Network, both Indiana 9th Congressional District candidates. Liz Watson and Trey Hollingsworth were invited. Incumbent Republican Hollingsworth declined the invitation. Tonight, on Standing Room Only, Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan's Health Care Forum.
Welcome, everyone, to the Johnson County Community Candidate Health Care Forum. My name is Rob Stone. I'm a doctor. I'm a Hoosier. In the mid to late 80s, I actually practiced in Johnson County for a while. I worked at the Immediate Care Center at the corner of County Line and Madison. And then for about 28 years, I worked as an emergency room doctor in South Central Indiana, and now I do palliative medicine and hospice care in Monroe County. So I just want to say that I'm also the director of an advocacy organization called Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan, and our goal is to extend healthcare coverage to as many Hoosiers as possible and eventually to cover everybody. Sometimes we call it universal Medicare. But I'm not here to advocate tonight. I'm here to listen. I'm here to learn from the women and men on this panel and from everyone in this audience. I just want to say a couple more words and then I'm going to get out of the way. National polling data from January on has shown that healthcare is either the most important or one of the most important issues that the electorate wants to hear candidates talk about. And so we had this idea, we wanted to have a healthcare forum, we wanted to have the candidates. Unfortunately, we're not able to get Trey Hollingsworth here. We've been working for months and months, but he's not here. We've got Liz Watson, we've got an amazing panel of local experts who will be introducing themselves and being introduced here in just a minute. We're not really having a debate, we're having a forum. And there will be plenty of time for question and answer. And so I will now introduce our wonderful, from WFYI, Jill Sheridan is going to be our moderator from here, and I'm going to try to stay out of the way.
Thank you, Rob. It's wonderful to be here tonight. My name is Jill Sheridan. I'm a reporter at WFYI in Indianapolis, and also a reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, which is a statewide network of the public radio stations here in the state of Indiana. And I've been on the health beat for a few years now, and I really have found a passion for the topic. I think probably because it impacts every part of our lives, and there's certainly no shortage of stories to tell. The landscape, the healthcare landscape in Indiana, though, is difficult and complicated, I've learned as I'm covering these stories the past few years. It's the intersection of policy, the intersection of social factors that affect us here in Indiana, and also the personal stories. So it's probably no shock at all that everyone's here tonight and that healthcare is at the top of issues as we head into this general election. So welcome, everyone, and I would like to introduce our panel now. Mary Beth Hensley is a doctor here in Johnson County, a family practitioner. We have Michael Colenda here. He is a director of Windrose Health Network. Also down there on the panel is David Dunkel. He's also a doctor and vice president of medical affairs with Johnson Memorial Health. And then a 9th District Congressional candidate, Liz Watson, here this evening. And again, Trey Hollingsworth was invited and also declined to leave any information to the topics that we've started. So we'd love to just go ahead and jump in and have all the panelists sort of introduce themselves and the topics that they would like to highlight tonight around the issues that we're talking about, Affordable Care Act, healthcare in Indiana, and all the many complicated issues that play into that. Dr. Colenda, I'll have you go first.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm glad to see you're here. I'm glad to know that this is as important to you as it is to me, because this is a terrific issue in our society that at times seems to be so misunderstood, overblown, and then times nobody knows it. How many of you got some of those handouts I was very clearly trying to pass out? That data is from the United Health Foundation's report they do annually. If you've never been on, look at that report. It is phenomenal in its information. And I share that with you because when I look at that report, and by the way, as the CEO of a federally qualified health center, we have to turn a report every 3 years to the federal government to keep our grant that talks about the need in our community and or in our state. And knowing that we're 38th out of 50 states, and in many areas even worse than that, such as obesity, it's very disconcerting to me because this hurts people, and it hurts people severely. And so my hope is tonight that we can talk a little about this and, you know, try to go in a direction about what can we do to make this thing more successful, because we've been talking about this for a long time in this culture. So let me give you your first question. Who was the first president, and what year did he approach Congress about a national health plan?
Harry Truman.
So who?
Truman.
Nope.
Wilson.
Who?
Wilson.
No.
Nixon.
No.
Teddy Roosevelt,
1912. Let me say that again. Teddy Roosevelt, 1912. We as a culture have been discussing this for over 100 years. We can't get it right. Lots of other countries have. We can't get it right. So that's just a thought for you. With that in mind, I don't know if I have a lot of profound things to say to you. I don't even know if I have any new things to say to you. But I do have information. I do have opinions. My staff will tell you I'm never short for opinions. And I hope that in the course of this, we can discuss this about what are we going to do for our entire culture, our entire society, not those with privilege, those with wealth, but everybody.
Thank you. Dr. So welcome this evening. I'm again Mary Beth Hensley, and I practice actually in Shelby County now. I was in Franklin for 8.5 years and changed about 6.5 years ago. So I'm a physician with Major Health Partners. I was the medical director of the St. Thomas Clinic here in Johnson County from 2006 through 2013, and an active physician there from 2003 to 2013. And one of my areas of expertise is particularly in life before affordable health care happened and life before access happened, and the need for the St. Thomas Clinic in the first place, and the difference in my practice in life since health care reform. I was speaking earlier about the number of Medicaid disability applications I used to complete for people, because in order to get access to health care, even for something temporary, you had to be unable to work at all. And the difference with Healthy Indiana Plan or the Affordable Health Care Act is that you could get access to health care even if you weren't full-time. So people who had real illness or injuries or other things that kept them off work had to be completely off work, and we had to fill out this long process to get them access to intermittent insurance. And now we have a lot easier access to that, or people can switch and have part-time employment. So the difference that people don't often understand is it was really all or nothing before. There wasn't kind of a fix where you could get a little bit of help but still stay in the workforce. And now the ability to have access through the healthcare exchange or through the Healthy Indiana Plan allows people to stay in the workforce. Even if they can't get a full-time job with benefits, they could have part-time work, maybe two part-time jobs, and get their benefits through the exchange. My second area of interest is pre-existing disease. I have a daughter who has ulcerative colitis. She was diagnosed in fourth grade. And I think about the change in that, like life before pre-existing clauses. And I remember there was a big change maybe around the time we started practice, where it was 6 months, you weren't covered for 6 months on your pre-existing things. And then it rolled into being covered by your new insurance policy, and how that would delay people's care and keep them from making life changes or cause all kinds of disruption if they had lost a job or had to change. And the concept that she would ever have to go without care is fearful to me, and I can't imagine going backwards.
for people, particularly, you know, there's some self-inflicted diseases. I suppose people who smoke and choose to do that in this era are maybe self-inflicted diseases. But for children like my daughter, and you'll hear about David's son as well, who have inflammatory bowel disease, it is, I just can't imagine her being punished for something that she didn't have any choice about. Her Remicade treatments are about $12,000 a dose. She has had to have them every 5 weeks for the last 3 years. And so we have good insurance and I have a decent income, and I still have been sent to collections on a debt that just rolled up too fast for us to keep up with it. So those are my particular passions, but I have a lot of experience in primary care and disease management and maneuvering healthcare systems, understanding health savings accounts and those things. So I'd like to be able to touch on those tonight.
Thank you.
Well, good evening. I'm Dr. Dave Dunkel. I'm a family physician with offices in Franklin and Greenwood. I practice medicine in Johnson County for the last 15 years and currently serve the role as Vice President of Medical Affairs for Johns Memorial Health. I feel that I have kind of a unique perspective in regards to the state of medicine, as I've had the opportunity to experience medicine from several different vantage points. As a freshman student here at Franklin College, I was diagnosed with acute leukemia. This led to several months of chemotherapy treatments, blood tests, etc., where I was able to experience navigating the healthcare system from the standpoint of a patient. As a practicing physician for the last 15 years, I've been involved as a provider. I also have a son with Crohn's disease, as Dr. Hensley stated. So I've interacted with healthcare standpoint or healthcare system from the standpoint as a parent. Finally, since becoming Vice President of Medical Affairs in Johns Memorial Health, I've also become much more knowledgeable about the financial pressures that charity care and insurance programs that pay pennies on the dollar place on healthcare organizations. As a physician, I'm trained to prioritize to triage my patients' complaints. I'm more concerned with someone's chest pain than I am with the splinter in their finger, though to them the splinter might be more visible. I feel to fix healthcare, we need to do a better job of truly prioritizing what's important. For example, I know lately the opioid crisis has gained a lot of media and political attention. According to the CDC, 72,000 people died from opioids in 2017. Do you know, however, that there's 480,000 deaths per year in the United States due to cigarette smoking? 41,000 of those due to secondhand smoke. Last year, nearly $170 billion was spent to treat the cancer, heart disease, strokes, lung disease, etc., directly a result of cigarette smoking. To me, this is a much larger problem in our country. However, this doesn't seem to be a priority if you turn on the news, read the paper. Also in medicine, approximately 20% of the population accounts for 80% of healthcare costs. In fact, 5% of the population accounts for 50% of total healthcare expenditures. These are the patients that are the chronically ill. This is the population that we really need to focus on. Coordinating the care of the most sick and vulnerable is the only way to move the needle in regards to lowering healthcare costs. However, we must also find a way to hold patients accountable. I think that's one thing that's been lost in some of our systems. A couple years ago, Medicare started not reimbursing hospitals for readmissions. One of those conditions is congestive heart failure. If a patient gets readmitted within 30 days with the same diagnosis, the hospital doesn't get paid. I can still remember watching a press conference and President then Obama saying it will make hospitals more efficient, which it has. There's been a lot of things that have gone in, a lot of processes to try to improve patient care. But we're lucky here, Johns Memorial Health actually is among the nation leaders in low readmission rate from congestive heart failure. So a couple years ago, we decided, you know, why can't we get this to zero? We don't want anyone to be readmitted to the hospital. So we went out, we closely looked at the people that had been readmitted. And almost every single person that was readmitted for a congestive heart failure exacerbation had refused home health care. A nurse coming to their house to make sure to reconcile their medications, to weigh them, to make sure they were doing well. They refused that. They were admitted to the hospital, then the hospital had to pay for their care. So I feel that as a society, we all must be in the fight together to improve the health care of our population, to improve these costs.
Thank you, Doctor.
Liz. Hi, everyone. First of all, thank you so much to the host of this event for setting up this important forum tonight. What I have found uniformly across all 13 counties in the 9th District is that getting out and listening to people. We all have our own healthcare stories. We all have our own experiences with the healthcare system. Listening to folks like the people I'm up here on this panel with, this is how we learn. This is how the person who wants to represent you should learn what it means to be your representative in Congress and should be able to take your priorities forward to Congress. Of course, the problem here tonight is that there's only one of us here, right? I am up in November against Trey Hollingsworth and he has declined to show. And I understand he was given the opportunity to submit written comments and he declined that opportunity also. Well, I am here and I am listening and I'm glad to be here with so many healthcare professionals because I am not a healthcare professional. I'm a lawyer by training, a labor and employment attorney, a fifth generation Hoosier. I specifically want to thank, if it was your child, one of the hosts of this event tonight, and acknowledge the really important work that If It Was Your Child is doing in Franklin in terms of standing up for children and standing up for public health and standing up and holding public institutions like the federal government accountable. This is very hard work. It's hard to go up against powerful forces like this day in and day out, and sometimes when your voice isn't being heard, but it's work that's starting to pay off, and so I want to recognize you. Healthcare is the number one issue that I hear about in the district in all 13 counties. People who cannot afford to fill their prescriptions, people who need treatment for substance abuse but can't pay for it. People who got coverage under the Affordable Care Act for the first time, but are scared to death that they are going to lose it if these repeal attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act work out. People who are on the brink of bankruptcy, paying for the costs above and beyond what their insurance covers, and who have no other choice but to keep paying until they go bankrupt. People in the middle class who are just one more hospital bill away from poverty. Business owners who can't afford to cover their workforce, who want to provide insurance coverage for their employees but simply can't afford it because the insurance system we have is unaffordable for them. I met a small business owner just last night in Johnson County who told me this exact story. I want to tell you just very briefly about a mom I met knocking doors in Johnson County. She's a mom, a single mom, who was able to get the coverage she needed when she had a pre-existing condition, breast cancer. And because she got the coverage she needed, she was able to be there for her child, for her little girl. She got treatment and she got better, and that little girl has a mom. If we go back to the days when people with a pre-existing condition can't get coverage, little girls like her daughter will grow up without mothers. We are the richest nation on earth. We cannot leave people for dead and dying. But that's what the attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act would do. And I won't stand for it, and I know you won't either. Thank you.
Thanks, Liz. Speaking of the Affordable Care Act, we know that more Hoosiers than ever now have health insurance. And the Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land. There have been efforts, yes, from lawmakers to try to change that, and our very own Attorney General, Curtis Hill, has joined a number of other states in a federal lawsuit to invalidate, saying that they cannot defend the ACA, including protections for people with pre-existing conditions, one of the most popular parts of the law that we know. If I could ask everyone to sort of comment on the Affordable Care Act, and about Indiana being involved in this federal lawsuit with a number of other states, as it goes to see how this healthcare law is the future of it here. David, maybe I'll have you comment first.
I think you'd be hard pressed to find a physician not in favor of the Affordable Care Act, because again, we're patient advocates, not turning away people for pre-existing conditions, letting children stay on their parents' insurance stage 26. Not requiring insurance companies to cover screening tests like mammograms, the great story you told, screening colonoscopies, making sure people are getting those tests where we can detect those cancers early. That's a great thing. And I agree, we can't until there's protections in place for these people, we can't have the Affordable Care Act repealed. Now, I understand this question, legality, I'm not a lawyer, about there are some questions, obviously, when the tax mandate got repealed with the legality of the Affordable Care Act, and I understand that, and it's a sticky situation, but again, I don't see how, as Hoosiers, we can be for that when that would leave approximately 3 million people with pre-existing conditions facing the chance of not having insurance.
Mm-hmm. We know that is such a popular part of the law, and we hear a lot of support around that. Mary Beth, what are your thoughts on Indiana and this lawsuit? Different pieces.
I think, again, so much of it is education for people who have any opposition to it. I think understanding group risk and that everybody has to be vested, they have to be vested lifelong. I think, like he noted, patients being able to stay on their parents' insurance till 26 allows a whole maturity gap for people who are without insurance and maybe suffering some kind of illness or injury that would put them behind financially. I already mentioned the ability to have insurance despite the ability to work full-time, because it previously was always full-time work, full-time benefits, part-time work, no benefits, and the ability to stay insured through the healthcare exchange, even if you're only able to work part-time, contributes to society. There are people who may not be able to work full-time jobs to get their benefits, but they could work part-time jobs and get their insurance through the healthcare exchange. So going backwards is just not acceptable. And the conversation for people who are opposed or don't understand it is a lot of it's about education. They don't understand their policy. They don't understand healthcare savings accounts and pre-tax dollars. They don't understand all the things they can use. I still have people, probably once a year, I'll have somebody say, I don't have insurance and they're 75. And I'll say, well, you have Medicare. Well, that's not insurance. Like, it's fantastic insurance. And they still are on the assumption that Medicare doesn't cover things. Medicare is fantastic insurance. And so over and over and over, just education and education and education about what their benefits are, how they use them, how they can shop, how they can be wise consumers. You know, when they have skin in the game, they pick and choose what tests they have to have or when they have to have them. And it helps us make better decisions about what's the priority. And so much of that, and my passion too with my patients, is about education, 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 and letting them know what their benefits are, hunting for the best service, the best cost, looking around it. And anybody who's not quite sure of how that dollar swings around, I think needs to sit down and see the consequences of not having it. Then you go back to bad debt, and because of that bad debt, there's all kinds of conversations. So it just can't go backwards.
Yeah, it's certainly confusing. I mean, you can't.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
I understand why people are confused. I mean, the system is very difficult, and education must be a huge part of that. Michael, if I could have you comment, you know, on the Affordable Care Act, what was that in the state of Indiana?
As I told you, you're going to hear a lot of good things, so I'll try not to repeat my. So let's do this a little differently. Show of hands, how many of you, if you lost your insurance today, would be step up to the next one and say, I got a pre-existing condition? Just about everybody in the room. Now let's keep them up if you know somebody who that would fall into that. Okay, all right, it's gonna hit a lot of people. With a wife who's 1 year recovered from breast cancer, I'm really concerned about this, okay? That's like, you gotta be kidding me, right? And so I think this is very ill-advised. Isn't that a nice way of saying dumb as hell, but ill-advised. Okay, it's a very ill-advised strategy. I'm not even sure that strategy is represented by a General Assembly, because our General Assembly, if you recall, supported HIP 2.0, had money even before we did HIP 2.0 set to pay for the expansion of Medicaid. So they were all about it, because they a number of people in General Assembly get it when it comes to what our the citizens of our state need, the common man needs, okay? So, one of the things that Dave talked about a second, let's talk about some of the issues that will go away. The pre-existing condition one I heard all the time when I was working at Windrose from 2003 to about 2008. That was hotly debated when this came to pass. So did the things around keeping kids on your adult, young adults on your insurance. Had two kids who did that, both of them college graduates, came out, started entry-level jobs. One didn't even have insurance, another one had what I would call catastrophic insurance. These are things that are being missed, and I think this is a party-driven decision that I don't think Indiana supports, quite frankly.
And certainly, we have a number of people in the healthcare world from Indiana on a federal level. It's interesting to see that intersection. Liz, your thoughts on Indiana and the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act is by no means perfect.
but it extended coverage to hundreds of thousands of Hoosiers and millions of Americans. And taking away that coverage is simply unconscionable. Our state's decision to enter into the lawsuit, this was a partisan decision. And that is what motivated all these other states that did that as well. Legal scholars who've commented on this lawsuit have called it spurious, have said that the claims have no basis. It's just a partisan gut punch to the Affordable Care Act. So the things we're talking about, taking away the coverage that, and you probably know that it's the coverage under HIP 2.0 that pays for things like substance abuse treatment, right? Taking away the coverage for people with pre-existing conditions means a lot of people in this room would be unable to get health insurance. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, about 30% of the public in Indiana has a pre-existing condition. What's a pre-existing condition? Acne? Pregnancy? Anxiety? So what does it mean to go back to the days when you couldn't get coverage if you had one of these conditions? Well, I think one of the very first stories I heard when I decided to run, I sat down with a woman who told me about her niece whose father had lost her job. The niece was 13 and she got diagnosed with cancer and they didn't have health care coverage. And then the Affordable Care Act passed, and you know what? The day it passed, they went, they got the coverage they needed. This niece, who they thought was never going to be able to seek treatment, got treatment. She got to walk across the stage of her high school graduation because of the Affordable Care Act. She's 19 years old today. Her mom and dad got to see her grow up. And they might not have her forever, but they have her for now because of the Affordable Care Act. Who are we as a nation if we're going to leave people behind? Who are we if we are going to leave people to get sick and die when we, the richest nation on earth, can afford to make sure that every single person has coverage?
Thank you. And on to another topic, you sort of touched on it briefly there. Even if you have insurance, we know that the high cost of healthcare, the affordability of healthcare, it's a major issue. And many families are battling that issue right now. And I know that it's on the minds of lots of people. If everyone could sort of discuss their thoughts about what could possibly be done to improve this situation. I know that the ACA originally, that was a goal, but we see the rising cost of drugs and treatment, and it can be scary. Michael, I'm happy to comment first.
Okay, as you know, multifaceted problem, multifaceted solution. There is no one solution. End of discussion. That's why we've been talking about this for 106 years. Okay? But one of the things I want to say to you, what gets me really charged up is what you've been hearing here, is people are getting, middle class people now are getting disenfranchised from this. It costs too much. I know people who pay more healthcare premiums than they do their mortgage. That's not a sustainable model in this culture. And this really calls into question one simple thing. How do we choose to govern? How do you want to govern? This is about government. It's about us. It's about community. It's about state. How do we want to govern? There are other models out there. There are other states that have done different things. Why not us? There are other countries that have done some different things successfully, despite the propaganda. Why not us? Are we too proud to say, hey, Canada's got a better system? Japan's got a better system, maybe? Why don't we figure it out? So my thought for you is this country has a long history of pulling together to help the country grow. Let's start with public health, public education, 1840. We realized we're entering the Industrial Revolution. It would be nice to have people could read and write and add and subtract. And it worked. It worked for us. The second one was when we did the Intercontinental Railroad, which we built, by the way, in the middle of the Civil War, if you didn't realize that. And why? If you connect the country so it was one country, and we could have business take place, to have commerce take place. Electrification of the U.S. in the 30s. Do you think we did that just to make a nice big lake in Tennessee? We did it because electricity was necessary for us to go forward in the 20th century and be successful. I don't know if you know this, 2009, Congress passed law, every citizen has a right to the internet and you can access it through libraries. Everybody. We pay for that, by the way. But why? It's necessary.
I would say to you, we need to look at healthcare this way. It is a man-made asset, not water, not land, man-made asset that is essential for successful living in the 21st century. And if you look at it that way, as opposed to, oh, who's going to pay for an island? Maybe we can figure out how we accomplish this. A man-made asset everybody needs.
Thank you.
You're listening to Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plans Healthcare Forum from August 27th on Standing Room Only.
David, will I have you comment on affordability and the price of insurance?
Well, again, I think it was great. Mike hit on the nail on the head. He's talking about a multifaceted problem. Like, I'll be honest. I mean, I work for a local hospital. I work for a hospital that has to turn a profit. How do you buy the new MRI machine? How do you invest in new technology if you can't make a dollar? And there was a day when healthcare organizations made 18, 20% margins. Now hospitals are happy at 2%, 3%. How do you reinvest in your infrastructure? How do you hire new physicians? So again, I'll be honest, Medicaid and Medicare hardly cover the cost of the care of the patient. They hardly do it. And we talk about costs, you look at, for years, a lot of Scandinavian nations have been lauded for their healthcare and their social programs. You take a country like Sweden. Sweden has an income tax rate of about 60% on average, compared to the United States at 27%. I think when you really get down and you ask people, do you want to pay 60% in tax, they're not, all of a sudden they backtrack a little bit. And I think that's tough. I think that part of the problem with pricing of healthcare is, obviously the insurance companies. I think that it's ridiculous that Dr. Hensley and I, we can't tell you how much it costs to see us in the office. It's different for everybody. Because one, Anthem Insurance says, hey, we're the biggest, or United now, we're the biggest insurer in the world. Dr. Dunkel, Dr. Hensley, we're not going to pay you what you want, because then we won't let you see any Anthem or United healthcare patients. We're going to pay you 70% of that, just because that's the way we do it. Well, then we have to artificially inflate our price. They pay this, and who gets hurt? The patient without insurance. Because in that contract that I signed with Anthem Insurance, I promised not to charge anyone else less. I'm not supposed to charge anyone else that cash pay per patient who says, hey, I've only got this amount. No, I'll still work out a deal with them, and that's what you need to do to take care of people. But again, there are costs associated with that. And I think we need transparency in pricing. You need to know how much a test costs. Mary Beth talked about shopping around. Healthcare's need to be good consumers. And like anything else, if you're going to buy a car, you're going to buy anything, you need to know the price. In our system right now, no one knows the price of anything. Again, our hospital prides herself as a low-cost provider. But how do you know that? How's the consumer know that? And I think that's a big problem.
Having people be more invested. Mary Beth, please.
I was laughing too, because he's not allowed to tell me what Anthem pays him, and I'm not allowed to tell him what Anthem pays me, because that's against the rules too. And in transparency of pricing, there's a lab, any lab now up in Greenwood, that you don't even have to have a doctor's order to go get a lab. And it just says how much they cost, and you can just pay cash for it. You can walk in there and order a la carte. In our meeting the other day, we were having a discussion about spirometry, a lung test, and whether we would have it done in the office by standard, or if some doctors wanted it to be done in the pulmonary clinic, in the pulmonary lab. And the question at hand was, what's the difference in the fee of doing it in office in a quick spirometry versus doing it in the pulmonary lab? And at our meeting, where we're all insiders, like you're not going to leak it out to anybody, they wouldn't tell us the cost difference of both of them, because nobody really knew. And like, well, yes, it's more. Well, how much more? It definitely would get more expertise and respiratory therapy and a whole line of education. But if you're going to charge the patient $500 for that when it costs $42 to do a spirometry in the office, and my MA can educate them fairly decent and decide if they need additional testing. So the transparency of services is hard even within a system, and certainly crossing lines where he's a Johnson Memorial employee, I'm a Shelby, a Major Health Partners employee. You can't talk this way. Now, there are reports of averages here or there and what the market in your area is. But if a patient comes in and says, how much is it going to cost me for that test? I can't say it costs this much. It does. It depends on your insurance. It depends on your deductible. It depends on your copay. There are services like PayNav that are available. But again, educating the patient and making it easy for them to get to PayNav to get that true cost is still difficult. And it's a constant game of just smoke and mirrors. My other point on cost is tort reform. We cannot have everybody being afraid of being sued for everything they own or everything they have based on
a medical decision that is in the best interest of the patient. And there's so much liability in research and development for pharmaceutical companies, and that also jacks our costs up quite a bit. So somewhere, not to knock any lawyers in the room, but making sure we have legal reform too. So, just kidding.
All right, Liz, go right to you.
So we spend about twice as much as any other country on healthcare, and we're on track to spend $50 trillion over the next decade. Why do we spend so much more? And our outcomes are often worse. Well, I think it's because, in part, that's how the pharmaceutical lobby, the health insurance lobby, want it. I don't think this is an economic crisis. I think it's a political crisis. I think you can draw a direct line between the problems with our campaign finance system and the problems with our healthcare system and our inability to solve those problems. So I can't ask my dad for millions to buy a seat in the United States Congress like Trey Hollingsworth did. You know, as long as we award seats in Congress to the highest bidder, we'll have representatives who represent the 1% and not us, who don't have to worry about not being able to pay for the high costs of their care. My opponent has actually taken tens of thousands of dollars from the pharmaceutical industry, from the health insurance lobby, and then he's voted exactly the way they told him to. He's voted to take away the ACA. He's voted to allow junk plans to exist that serve nobody but the health insurance industry. He's voted to take us back to the days when you couldn't get insurance with a pre-existing condition. That's what happens when we allow people's votes to be bought. That's why I don't take corporate PAC money at all, because I think it's so important that we take on the big pharmaceutical lobby, that we take on the health insurance lobby, and that we start doing the right thing for consumers of care. Now, I think the right thing for consumers of care is to make sure that we cover all of us. We have 48,000 people in the 9th district who are still uninsured. We know Medicare is a system that works. It holds down costs. We just heard the doctor say that. It's incredibly effective. It's incredibly effective for people over 65. It would be incredibly effective for the rest of us. It's a system that I would like to see available to each and every one of us.
Thank you. The last topic that we had that we would like to discuss is the issue of Indiana's health rankings and our health measures as a state. We know that oftentimes we're ranked right there at the bottom in many of these measures: diabetes, obesity, smoking. I'd like for you to try to outline this humongous topic, how you would like to see change and what areas you would like to see healthcare for Hoosiers change in these measures in the short term or the long term, or however you'd like to touch on that. Mary Beth, I'll have you go first.
So some of the studies recently have shown access to walking trails, access to exercise facilities are one of the biggest and most effective change mechanisms to change the healthcare in a community. And I think particularly here in Franklin and Johnson County, that you're seeing that happen around the community and people getting out and being active. The thing I see in the physician world is so much of the shaming of obesity. It has just happened in the last probably 5 years where they diagnosed or considered obesity a medical problem. We don't get paid just to manage obesity as a diagnosis, as the coding system's called ICD-10. If my primary diagnosis is obesity, it's not a covered service for the patient. Regardless of how important it is and how much it deals with their hypertension, their diabetes, all other consequences of life. And so having change and finally acknowledging that as a medical condition, but moving forward to say, yes, we have access to programs and services and nutrition information and counseling and activities in the public forum is just so very important. I mean, people, surprisingly, they still don't know. We can talk about it 100 times a day. I said to a lady today, I said, have we talked about food diarrhea before? And she said, yes. And I said, you know, you still get to heaven regardless if you're heavy or you're not heavy, or if medical problems or not, you might get there faster. But if you want to make change, I'll help you and I'll be there for you. And I'm not going to judge you if you don't want to make change. the part of that, though, is then the financial consequences. If they don't make change, that's the patient that's going to be hospitalized more and cost the system more. So I think so much public effort to getting access to exercise facilities and access to public education, parks, recreation, making those affordable for patients in all areas, and then also having a medical staff and a medical community that'll be part of that and be part of helping their patients in that journey if they're coming for support.
Mm-hmm. David, would you like to comment?
Well, I start out my opening statement talking about, again, I think we're forgetting about the importance of the costs associated with tobacco abuse. I just feel, again, it's great to serve us in our state and our country that we're forgetting about the economic impact. In fact, I was looking today, $2.93 billion, the annual health care costs in Indiana directly related to smoking. Medicaid costs caused by smoking in Indiana, $589.8 million. Smoking caused productivity losses in Indiana, $3.17 billion. In 2016, $9.5 billion was spent by the tobacco industry on advertising. In the fiscal year so far, 2018, states will collect a record $27.5 billion from the tobacco taxes and legal settlements, but will spend only $721.6 million, less than 3% of that, on prevention and cessation programs. That is a huge, huge issue. We have got to fix that. We got to fix it now.
Liz, would you like to comment on Hoosier's poor health measures?
So we've talked about the smoking problem, the opioid abuse problem. One problem that we haven't touched on is we have a maternal mortality rate that's twice the national average, the eighth worst infant mortality rate in the country. A thing that I think a lot of us know is that we have a shortage of mental health treatment professionals across this district, and that is a very serious problem because we have a lot of families in real need. Actually, the last time the federal government looked at this, I think 12 out of our 13 counties were classified as a mental health shortage area. Some of the things that I think we ought to do, I think we ought to cover the 48,000 who are still uninsured. I think we ought to be very clear that we will not repeal the coverage that we have. Trey Hollingsworth, when he voted for repeal without meeting with Hoosiers first, said, well, of course there has to be a bridge, but there isn't a bridge. It's a bridge to nowhere, and there has been no plan. I support real investment and real funding to solve the opioid crisis. There's a bill that Elijah Cummings has introduced called the CARES Act, which is sort of like the Ryan White bill that was introduced to deal with HIV and AIDS and to really address that problem in a very serious and comprehensive way. The CARES Act would do that. We need to make real federal investment, not these drop in the bucket things that, you know, we have been doing so far. I want to talk for a second about our schools, because we haven't really touched on that. I have two kids who are 8 and 12 who go to my elementary school in Bloomington, where I went growing up. I go to schools across the district, and I hear our schools are often where these kids, their needs are being met when their families are suffering trauma, poverty, opioid addiction. The schools are meeting the needs, but they're doing so without the resources that they need. We ought to have a counselor in every school. We ought to be having a nurse in every school. We ought to have mental health resources for students in every single school. And we're not meeting that need at all. And that's a question of priorities and values. It's a question of where the money goes. And we can solve that problem. We can serve the needs of our kids in school. And the last thing I'll say is, let's not forget the importance of protecting our environment in all of this. Dealing with the environmental toxins that we have in Indiana, we do have a lot of old industrial sites here in our state. We need agencies like the EPA not to be gutted and defunded and to do their job of enforcing our environmental protections. And we need to not roll back the protections that are designed to ensure that we have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink. This is critical to our health.
Michael?
I'm not going to get as specific because I'm not sure with such a broad case issue we have, but I'd like to say some of the following. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a philosopher, one of the premier philosophers in our culture in the 1800s, and he was quoted as saying, the first wealth is health. Now, that's as true then as it is today, and I don't know if Americans embrace that, because I think they look outside themselves for health and finding health. So, just to give you a little example of this, please take this paper for a minute and go to the column that says Best State, which according to the United Health Foundation had the leading number. And if you notice there, when you take a look at diabetes and you go to the right, what state do you see? Colorado. Best state for lowest rate of diabetes. Go further down to diabetes. Go to the right. What do you see? Colorado. Now, here's a little number that's not on there. State that has the highest amount of people actively working, exercising five times a week or more. Best state. Want to make a guess on this one? Colorado. Why? That's the question. Why is that culture, why is that community, a set of communities, why? And why can't we do it? Well, I think the answers are, first of all, each of us has to embrace, doctors can only do so much. They'll tell you that right out of the box, if you're not gonna do certain things. And some of the things that affect us are six chronic illnesses, of which are lifestyle driven. It's what we eat, when we exercise, what we do with our view of life, like thinking positively, things like that all come into play. We are in control of this. We can do this. But that culture in Colorado, for some reason, it's done. Okay, and I can go into lots of reasons, but so I guess that my thought is, one is, this is acceptance of it's my health, and I'm gonna take care of me. That's number one. In this, my message is, everybody gets bored in this one. Okay, maybe it is 50% taxation in Sweden. Would you like to take a look at their lifespan? A hell of a lot longer than ours. Is that a bit? How much is that worth to you? That's the question. How much is it worth to you? You know, the Canadians, if you got this thing on the back, you notice Canadians, 5 years longer. Oh, by the way, you talk to Canadians about their health plan, they'll tell you, we like it, and we know we pay for it. So I guess my thought is, we gotta have it individually, we gotta have it at governmental level and community level, and then I think we have to talk about how do we always have to measure this in the business model? Once upon a time, healthcare was created by religious organizations. That's the basis of our country. Most hospitals came out of some kind of, now they're big business. $2.2 trillion. Now they're big business, as is insurance, as is pharmaceuticals. We don't have to have that unless you want to do something. Of course, you know, I know I now sound like a socialist to many of you. That's fine, you know, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you about ways things were done in our society for decades, and that is, the group got together and figured it out and made some sacrifices.
Thank you. We would love to open it up to questions at this point. I will ask that anyone with a question, I'll try to hear you, speak loudly, and I can repeat the question. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to direct a question to Ms. Watson.
Go ahead.
You finally got to the issue of health, of Medicare for All. But what we never get is the cost. What Medicare for All would cost.
So the question is for Liz about Medicare for All and the cost of that.
Right, so I am a supporter of Medicare for All, along with 70% of the American public. That's 52% of Republicans and upwards of 80% of Democrats. Polling just came out. The other very important data point that recently came out came from a Mercatus study that was funded by the Koch brothers and stuffed into a footnote, I think in the back of the study, was actually that the overall costs of going to a Medicare for All system would actually be cheaper by $2 trillion over the course of a decade. I think they studied 2021, assuming implementation 2021 to 2031, than our healthcare costs now, that we would actually bring down healthcare costs. And how did they get to that conclusion? Because you have to think about the overall costs that we all pay for care, right? So we pay very significant costs in terms of what we pay, administrative costs and overhead. Doctor's offices have to employ whole, you know, staffs of people to negotiate with insurance companies to try to get coverage. The overhead costs associated with that are very, very expensive. We know that if we could negotiate prescription drug prices under Medicare, just as the VA does, we would dramatically reduce costs.
One of the things that they don't talk about, I never hear people talk about this, is the savings associated with having healthy people, right? Because when you're healthy, you're able to be in the workforce, you don't need to rely on cash assistance programs as much, you don't need to move to Social Security, to a disability program, because you are healthy and you can work. So the cost of making sure that that people get that coverage that allows them to lead a healthy, happy life and participate in our workforce and the economic productivity that we gain associated with that is something no one ever talks about, but I think that we should.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
How does that answer pair with Dr. Dunkel, his opinion that Medicare does not cover the cost? So when people hear that, they're saying you're advocating something that's going to drive the professionals out of business because it's not covering the cost.
You know, we talk about Canadian healthcare system, the Swedish healthcare system. The other thing is Americans, we love our care. We love to do what we want to do. You have to understand too, some of these Medicare for all socialized type programs, don't think it's not going to be dictated what you can and cannot do. There's a reason why so many people come across the border to get their gallbladders out. I mean, that happens. There's a reason why my partner left the Canadian medical system to come practice in the United States, because he was working 16 hours a day going bankrupt.
Since 30 years ago.
To think that the system would be the same as it is now, just cost less, I think is idealistic. Also, I think coverage does not equal health. Just because people have coverage does not mean we're going to make the population healthier. Again, I think going back to what Dr. Hensley said, you need community initiatives. We need more trails. We need to make sure our children aren't obese. We need to watch the nutrition in the schools. We need to get the Coke machines out of the schools. We need healthy snacks. We need kids to understand you have to exercise every day. I have patients who they can take PE class online now. Are you kidding me? Online. I mean, we have got to get our children exercising. Again, so much what we look at is fixing the end. The people, as I talked about, 80% of our healthcare dollars being spent on 20% of the population. But we need to focus on prevention as well. And we need to start early.
Dr. Hensley, one comment.
So, and I'm not even saying that Dr. Dunkel and I necessarily differ, but Medicare is not a poorly paying insurance. It doesn't pay top dollar. It doesn't pay bottom dollar either. So Medicaid may be a different story. So the Medicaid reimbursements are a lot lower than Medicare, but Medicare insurance in general is a reasonable payer. They pay on time, you submit a bill and you get reimbursed. Your reimbursement is electronic versus a lot of the private insurance companies will hold that payment for up to 3 denials before they'll submit it. So there is a balance in that it's not, because you could get really fearful, and the Canadian physician he's referencing practiced in Canada 30 years ago. He's been here a long time, so things could be different now than they are then. But having one payer and one mandate and not freedom of choice isn't necessarily what I think either one of us would advocate, but we also see that everyone needs access. But I have yet to meet a starving physician. I mean, I certainly have had financial issues in my career and balance and budget and all the things, and the days of making $500,000 as a primary care doctor are over, and frankly they probably should be. Our neurosurgeons, our cardiothoracic surgeons that are going 7 years longer than we did to school and have to be on their feet for 18 hours for an OR, they need to make that dollar. I don't need to make $500,000 a year. Would I love to? Sure. But it is that reasonable. So a lot of people, I remember a lot of urologists griping about their pay, and I know two of them who just retired at age 55, and I've never seen any of them in a food bank. They're all fine. So it is a yin and a yang that, we make $200,000 in primary care. Woe is me, my peer that retired, opened my practice. I know he had years in the 70s where he made $400,000 and didn't make $150,000 in the late 90s. But that you have to balance it. Medicare in general is kind of in the middle of the ballpark, and finding a way for that to be consistent and reimbursements to be consistent is really important.
So, that's in here, yes. Yeah.
All we want to talk about is money. I'd like to talk about value.
because Americans in the room will pay for stuff of value. Anybody gone to a Colts game lately? Did you get your money's worth? Oh, by the way, you got charged a lot. So when we talk about value of this, and when I talk about in Canada, they have 5 years longer health span on an average. I don't know if that's valuable to you, I guess. If it's not, then continue the discussion about money. Tao Te Ching was written by a man called Lao Tzu 2,500 years ago. One of the lines of the Tao Te Ching goes like this, and this is not word salad. A man who knows when enough is enough will always have enough. We have lost a sense of value about healthcare. And part of it is because our focus is on what? Disease only? Health is not just the elimination of disease. Health is more than that. The data I gave you guys out there about suicidality, that frightens me for our culture. The second leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 34 in this country is suicide. Let's talk about money now, shall we? Because that's not about, that doesn't make any sense. They chose to leave life. Really? So that's where I want to say, when we talk about this sometimes, are we always going to measure it by the money? Is that what we're going to do? Because that's not quality of life for me. And yes, I will pay more. And yes, you can tax me more. Because I want quality of life for me and my community.
Thank you. Anyone else?
My question for everyone is, what is the role of, say, local health departments? I'm from Lawrence County, so 2 years ago we had a hepatitis C outbreak. Mm-hmm. Now we have nearly 50 people with hepatitis A. Austin, Indiana has over 230 people with HIV. And I'm just interested to learn how we can empower health departments, given that Indiana ranks 49th in public health spending.
If you want to guess where we sit when it comes to how much money we spend, is our legislators let us spend on public health, $38 a Hoosier. That's number 49. Hey, we're number 49. Woohoo! And yeah, that causes some real problems for our hardworking health departments because they really don't have any resources. Now, by contrast, go back on this thing, take a look. This Hawaii, of course, you know, they got great weather unless there's a tornado or, you know, a hurricane or a volcano. But guess what who spends the most money in the nation per capita on health care? Public health, Hawaii. And there's a correlation between that and some of their public health issues. I mean, you got to invest in it.
About time for probably just about one more question. Sir?
Somebody mentioned the high cost of prescription drugs.
Yeah.
Some people have to go to Canada to get life-saving drugs because they can't afford to buy the same drug in the United States. How is it that Merck or Lilly can sell a drug in Canada for a fraction of the price it costs here? Why do people have to go to Canada to get their drug? What can be done about it?
I think we could do a whole other panel on that.
I don't know the answer to the whole question, but I will tell you, I think the last thing I read said that the last three or four years, generic drug prices have increased by 200%. Things have definitely gotten out of hand.
Interesting conversation to support capitalism.
Yeah.
One step,
yep.
One part
right.
of the economy, and then say, but we can't have capitalism in medicine because, you know, you put situations like that at hand. But on the flip side, they say, well, we can't have socialism because, so some kind of melding in the middle.
So we need to take a different angle from this,
yeah.
from what we've been doing for 100 years.
I would like to just address the prescription yeah. drug price
sure.
Question for a second. Just to give you an example, so in England, the price of an EpiPen 2-pack recently, they priced it out $69. Here in the US, $600. So kids are having their EpiPens rationed because the parents can't afford to continue buying them. That's what happens when we don't allow for the negotiation of prescription drug prices. We know that where the VA is involved in negotiations over healthcare costs, they're able to hold them down. We need to allow the federal government to negotiate prescription drug prices, and the reason it's not happening is money in politics. It's very, very clear. So there is a corruption problem happening in Congress, and it's the corruption of allowing the pharmaceutical industry to dictate that Congress cannot actually do its job and provide for these negotiations to happen to hold down costs for healthcare consumers. And how do we solve the corruption problem of the folks who've been bought and paid for in Congress? You solve it by voting them out in November.
If we just had 5 more minutes, we could have solved everything. I want to thank our co-sponsors, if it was your child, the 9th District Disability Caucus, Brown County Common Ground, Brown Countyans for Quality Healthcare. I want to thank our panelists, Dr. David Dunkel, Dr. Mary Beth Hensley, Dr. Michael Kalenda, and I want to thank our moderator, Jill Sheridan, and I want to thank Liz Watson for coming. I wish Trey Hollingsworth had joined us, and I especially want to thank my wife, Karen Greenstone, who is the organizer par excellence, who really made this thing happen.
You've been listening to Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plans Healthcare Forum on August 27th on the campus of Franklin College in Franklin, Indiana.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.